Well, you all heard Matins this morning. I imagine most of you were at breakfast. You weren't at breakfast. Well, it was what's the girl's name?
Eileen.
Yeah. She based it on the. Well, yeah. What was it? Anna was the name of a little girl who. Girl who had been bad. I don't understand all the background of it. She didn't explain it all, but this little girl had been badly treated. Now, what was she doing? Writing or talking or something?
She was talking, and the book came out of it.
Okay.
She's a little girl.
Okay, little girl, and she talks about Mr. God. All right. Now, what feelings or thoughts did you have this morning as you? Listen to that little girl's thoughts of what God was like. Do you agree that that's what God is like?
I had a reaction that it was more of a relationship between her and another older being. Not necessarily how he is, but it was how the girl could relate to God.
Mm-hmm.
That is how he is. And I think there's a difference between the relationship and who he is.
Okay.
Suggested more to me about the girl than about God. I was thinking more that she was a precocious girl than the type of God she was depicting.
Okay. Anything else? Any reactions you have?
I just felt for her age it was just her way, this mister was just maybe one of the only ways she knew of showing respect.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't she say Mrs.? Just ask yourself, run, try this little mental experiment. Suppose the Matins had been exactly as presented, but with this difference. It was always Mrs. God. How would you have responded? What would you have felt?
I think ill at ease.
Ill at ease.
Because I think I've always thought of the master and gender because of the use of the he in the Bible and it's referred to as he in a abrupt change is more traumatic than even if he isn't he or he isn't she, you know, there may be no gender at all. However, Christ, he came as a man. And it had more of you have that God is a person, isn't it? And we have he or she or it, and I hold it to the he because he was a man here on earth.
Well, now wait a minute. Jesus was a man.
Okay.
But was God the Mother a man? You know, this is the week of Trinity Sunday. We speak of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Why don't we speak of the Mother, Son, and Holy Spirit? Well, now obviously there are historical reasons. The Bible speaks of the Father. Jesus said, taught us to speak of God as Father. The Hebrews spoke of God as He. Does that say something about the Hebrews or about God?
Doesn't it also come in from God as the initiator, and the male is always the initiator in the traditional sense of how we see something male?
And that's how we see it, but is that the result of our culture, or? You know, is the male really the initiator, or have we been taught that the male is supposed to be the initiator? You know, they're well, okay.
I don't know if it's a misinterpretation or not, but I think there are some verses that say, he who, where Christ says, he who knows me knows the Father, and this kind of thing. And I think that's a couple of things. I don't know if that's a, if that is something, an interpretation that was made on Scripture by the people who wrote it down or not, but this is something that I picked up on.
But do you think Jesus meant to say thereby that God was made?
Well, that's the only information I have. I mean, from, you know, my looking at Scripture.
Do you think God is male?
Well, no. He who knows Christ knows the Father.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what Christ said. So, and then Christ makes reference to, he who knows the Father knows me also. I couldn't pick out the exact places, but there are some that said in a couple different places, I believe.
Okay.
But I just wonder if that's a misinterpretation by the people who wrote down the Scripture, or if that is, if that's what it really was meant to be written down, if that was accurate. That's where I would question.
The problem is language.
Steve?
It seems like, first off, the Hebrews' idea of God started in the Old Testament, and which was, at least from the way I see the Old Testament, a patriarchal society. And the God they described also embodied many traits that we call masculine. He was a judgmental God, he was an angry God, he's a big, strong father figure type of. The image that they portrayed had a lot of masculine characteristics that seemed to also play out of their image of their ideal king and so forth. And so his gender seemed to be fairly firmly established as an image of the God of the Old Testament. By the time the New Testament came along.
Okay.
Yeah. And speaking, to what Jesus said in the Bible and stuff, is Jesus not also a product of his culture? He was raised a Jew, was a Jew, he lived in these times, and in order to communicate with the people that he was living with, etc., did he not also use the language, he dressed? Like most people did then, he lived as most people did. He also then therefore used the language of the people of that day, and so I don't see any contradiction there. Jesus could use Father because that was his, perhaps the way that his culture spoke. That doesn't necessarily mean that he saw God as his Father necessarily, as being male.
As a Christian, doesn't he cry out, of course, everyone says, Abba, Abba, Father, a couple of months, Father, forgive them, but they know not what to do. This kind of thing comes across in several different places.
Yeah. He's a product of his culture,
How else could he address God, except as the Hebrew people address him?
Now, Barb's point is that in everything he said, he would be talking the language that his hearers would understand. If he had said, my mother, the Jews would have, Jews traditionally have really put women in an inferior role. One of the traditional Jewish prayers, begin the day, Lord God, I thank thee that I was not created a woman. to try to use a female metaphor for God to a Jewish people would have just put them completely off. Women were weak and inferior and really not even worthy of the service of God.
She was standing right over there anyway.
That's right. So, Peg, you.
Yeah, just along with what you were saying, I wonder if, we didn't start out describing God with the male trace and then made it kind of a gender thing where it really wasn't a, doesn't have to be a gender thing. I could be a a father to people and fathering them as far as the way I would treat them, the way we use the word, or a man can mother people and meaning that they can be gentle, or we use the word mother to mean these words that don't necessarily have anything to do with your gender.
Mm-hmm. Right. We use father and mother symbolically, don't we? Well, we speak of George Washington as the father of our country. We imply nothing at all about his sexual proclivities. Sure. That would be interesting. You know, Martha Washington could be the father of our country. You know, that would jar us a little bit. But
we would say founder.
Pardon?
We would say the founder of our country.
That's right. We'd shift away then. We'd shift away from the sexual metaphor. Now, the thing about something for a moment, if we want to check, there are many cases where we don't know whether something is male or female. For example, baby chicks. It's a real problem. People who raise baby chicks really need to know what their sex is very quickly. And I think they still send them off to Japan, where there are specialists in sexing chickens.
They do their own sexing.
They do their own now? I know it used to be true not too many years ago that they... Well, anyway, there's a certain way in which you tell. You know what to look for. Some forms of life, or lower forms of life, we often, the characteristics, when baby is born, everybody knows when a human baby is born, whether it's male or female, we know what to look for. Well, with animals, insects, or sub-insects, I forget the name of my phyla now, we don't look for the same things. We start looking for functions. But we've got to have some kind of criteria, and the criteria will have to do with sexual function. And when we get down to animals that perform, let's say, like an amoeba, amoeba's a plant, a protozoan, is it male or female? We say neither. It has, because it reproduces asexually. All right, now, the criteria that we use in distinguishing male from female, those criteria do not apply to God. I think everyone would agree. God does not have genitalia. God does not reproduce sexually or asexually. So clearly we're using a metaphor here. We're speaking symbolically. And I think it's very important to begin with that we recognize that all of our language about God is symbolic. All of it is metaphorical for a very simple reason. God is not like anything that we know. I can tell you literally what a collie is. I can describe a collie because I can say a collie is about so high and about so long, and you've all had experience of length and height. So you know what I'm talking about. I may even be able to point to a collie and say, there goes one. Or I say, no, that's not a collie, but if you make it about 6 inches shorter or something, or I can point to a beagle and show you, say, well, now if that beagle were, then it would be like a collie. But how can we do this with God? God is not like anything we experience. We are compelled to use metaphors or symbols. Some people object to that word symbol, or last night we were talking about myth, same problem as myth. Some people think that symbol, myth means not real. Not at all. To say that we can only speak of God symbolically, that every term we apply to God is symbolic, is not to say that God isn't real. I think it's really to say that God is the most real thing of all. God is so real that he is presupposed in everything that we say and think. And recognizing God, thinking about God, talking about God is something like the problem that a fish has with recognizing water. Fish has real trouble recognizing water because it's never seen not water. And if God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being, then God is so real and so present that we cannot see him. Have you ever thought about that? I like the way somebody put it once. The only reason we can recognize an elephant is because we rarely see them. Things that are always in your experience, you're not aware of. You take for granted. You have trouble spotting. It's the most common things that we have trouble seeing. Well, now, I want to try another one. Last Monday night, a play was presented by Norman Dietz, old Emir, the pot maker. How many of you were here Monday night and heard the play? Okay. Now, clearly, Emir was a symbol for God, a metaphor for God. I'm just curious as to how you reacted to that. Did anybody have any reactions to the play and to Emir, particularly to Emir as a metaphor for God? Do you think God is like Emir? Was that a satisfactory metaphor? Did that give you insight into the nature and activity of God?
What that kind of implies is that God has characteristics that we ourselves try not to have.
Can you go on just a little?
Well, it's just his rage in which he destroys his creation, you know.
Okay.
Let's see. You said the word before, petty, right?
We were talking about that a few minutes ago.
You know, he's petty. He's talking back to his creation, kind of a childish little. Of course, the pot is being more childish, but he's also being childish in the way he's talking back to the pot.
Yeah. You recall some of the, when Emir is described, well, he's big, he's a head taller than anyone else, strong, flashing eyes, powerful. You get the feeling nobody can stand up to Emir. Well, you say, well, that's a good metaphor for God. But is it a good metaphor for God? What is it?
It seems like it's such a, well, first off of the play, I have a problem with probably so much of humor over the pot, relating the pot to being human. But I think it's such a lousy metaphor for God that that's part of the reason why the Jews had such a hard time seeing Jesus in front of their messianic prophecies. They're expecting this big, strong, masculine, heavy-duty dude with flashing eyes who was going to come and just do away with everything. And instead, they get this weak, anti-waste preacher who goes and gets himself killed at 33. Obviously, the image symbolism was didn't match. They're totally inadequate, and yet they're totally true.
Okay, I'm glad you added that, because I'm not trying now to tell you to discard metaphors. If you discard all of your inadequate metaphors about God, you discard any possibility of thinking and talking about God. You've got to use metaphors, and all metaphors are inadequate. Inadequate doesn't mean wrong. It just means they leave something out. And it may be important to know what a metaphor leaves out, or what a metaphor asserts that it doesn't mean to assert. Because I think that many atheists are really people who are rejecting the consequences of certain metaphors. I want to. Oh, I'm sorry.
One of the, in tying the last comment you made, one of the problems is that not only do we ask people to accept God, but more than that, we ask them to accept our image of God. We don't ask them necessarily to be, or if we ascribe love to be a part of God, we don't ask them to be open to that love, but also to accept the image of God that created that love, or made that love present in our lives. And I'm not so sure that we ought to do that.
But do we have any choice? Can you talk about God except either explicitly or implicitly by presenting some image? You take one of the probably the image of God that most people would find least objectionable is God is love. You know, we like that. That appeals to all our positive. It begs the question of sex and whether is God a king or is God a father. There are differences between kings and fathers. You know, God is love, but even that one, what kind of love? We've known all kinds of love. There's, for example, the love of a mother who won't let her 42-year-old son get married. There is indulgent love. There's tyrannical love. All kinds of love. Love can be weak or love can be strong. Of course, now we say, well, I mean all the good ones. God is love in all the good senses. But what are the good senses? When I was a lad, I had to practically memorize this little book, A Short Explanation of Dr. Martin Luther's Small Catechism. It wasn't short enough. Gave us a... How do you know that there is a God? Question 24. And it gives all the reasons I know that there is a God. What is God? Question 25. What is God? We had to memorize all these. God is a spirit. And then parentheses, a being endowed with mind and will, but without a body. I've never seen one of those. So I don't. But what do I get? I got a sort of a cloud with a mind and a will. Question: are mind and will really separate? That's really based on a psychology that may or may not be good. I mean, are mind and will separate?
Spirit of 76 might be an appropriate slogan
for Christians. Spirit of 76. Yeah, because that's using the word spirit in another sense, but maybe that's a better sense, you know. Maybe when we say God is a spirit, it would be much better. See, when this term became popular, people believed, as we tend not to, in the existence of disembodied beings. We tend to think that something that does not have a body doesn't exist. Everything in this world either has some kind of physical embodiment or it is not. It's an abstraction, like honesty. Honesty is an abstraction, doesn't really exist, except in the mind of somebody who has a body. Well, that's the way we tend to think, not everybody. But consequently, we have trouble with the word spirit. But now maybe, if we thought about the spirit of Holden Village, God is a spirit in that sense. Maybe, but again, that's a metaphor. I wanted to go on to the next one. The next one is the one that really intrigues me. God is unchangeable. Now, they always cited Bible passages here to back it up. I am the Lord, I change not, Malachi 3:6. Thou art the same, and thy years shall have no end, Psalm 102:27. And I love the way that in this book they like to turn to the Psalms, which are poetry, for their literal proofs of things. But the problem of the unchangeability of God, I suggest that would never have made it in here. You know, there are other things. They could have said God is male and cited all kinds of proof passages, but they didn't. Why? Because Greek philosophy didn't emphasize the maleness of God. And a lot of this book is full of Greek philosophy. And one of the things, one of my old systematics professors at the seminary used to insist, Christian theology is independent of philosophy. Now let us consider the local and illocal presence of God, his substance and his accidents. But the unchangeability of God, I would just suggest, is a metaphor that serves us poorly. Because if you believe that God is unchangeable, then he is unaffected. He is Aristotle's unmoved mover. And how can such a God care or grieve or suffer or create or redeem or inspirit? Well, what's the alternative to an unchangeable God? Well, the alternative is a changeable God. A God whom we can affect A God who becomes different because of what we do. A God whose nature is altered by our behavior. When Allah is that's almost blasphemous to many people. Well, you know, it limps. There are problems with that's sort of saying we create God. But if you were to take your metaphors exclusively from the Bible and not from Aristotle, you would be much, much more inclined to have us creating God in this sense. You know, I mean in the sense in which if I say something sad and you cry, I created your tears. Okay. If we took our metaphors exclusively from the Bible, we would have a God whose nature is changing as a result of what we do. And God repented.
Yeah, one of the most beautiful examples in that is Jonah. You know, when he goes out to save Nineveh. You know, and God says, "I'm going to get Nineveh. You know, go talk to him and stuff." And then Nineveh changes his mind, and Jonah bitches about it. He says, "You know, why did you do that, God? You know, you weren't supposed to change your mind. They were supposed to die. God changed his mind."
I want to tell you where I want to wind up. I hope that you're all in a nice mood so that I can wind up reading you just a few pages from the prelude to a book by Martin Buber called Eclipse of God, which is so beautiful. Also, since Buber is Jew, and I said some unkind things about Jewish conceptions of God at the beginning, I can redeem myself maybe by reading this again. But let me just at this time I suggest to you three metaphors that I have found increasingly meaningful over the years. One of them is the spatial metaphor with respect to God. I was taught, as probably most of you were, to think of God as up. You know, pious look is like that. You know, and God is in heaven, which has an upward connotation. Now, but up has some other connotations that I found not as meaningful as I would like. Up is far away. It is distanced. It is also overseeing. You know, it is watching. I'm not denying it, but I like down. God is down. He is the ground of all that is. The everlasting arms, in the one in whom we live and move and have our being, out of which we grow, the foundation, the source of all that is. You might think about it sometimes. In your private devotions or in your corporate worship, you tend to visualize, to use metaphors, and think of God. You know, I remember when I was a little kid saying my nightly prayers. God was a man with a beard in the upper corner of the room. And I'm not making fun of that. And now I'm more likely to think of God as down below holding up the house. Another one is God, it's the time metaphor. Most of us have learned to think of God as backward in time. In fact, this little book tells us, how do we know there is a God? Answer. First answer is, from the existence of the world. Every house is builded by some man, but he that built all things is God. The heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament showeth his handiwork. From the creation of the world, the things are seen, but Christ created by God. All right. In other words, God is the one who back there created the world, and who calls each one of us, you know, pushes each one of us into existence, makes things happen. God is the, he's the pusher. still, God is the cause, the efficient cause. Now, I like that very little for a whole bunch of reasons. It was the Newtonian concept of God. It was very consistent with deism. God wound up the clock way back there, and now she's running on. It is very compatible with Skinnerian determinism. it raises, I find it difficult to preserve a concept of freedom, real freedom, with a God who is back in time. What's the alternative? I would suggest, I think increasingly, of God as forward in time, up ahead. That means, well then how does God affect the present? God functions as a lure. The image, Nietzsche, who became famous or notorious or infamous for saying God is dead. Now, I'm not going to make a Christian out of Nietzsche. But Nietzsche was largely reacting against the metaphors of God that dominated his time. And one place Nietzsche says, I would not believe in a God who could not dance. The image of the cosmic dancer, in other words, was important to Nietzsche. Someone up ahead, presenting an array of possibilities in a fascinating manner and drawing us toward them. Again, this metaphor limps too. All metaphors limp. But I have found it increasingly meaningful to think and speak of God as the one who is up ahead. One other is, and it's a fundamental Lutheran metaphor, God as the one who is on our side, the companion, the concept of justification by grace, which is also, you know, metaphor, justification, it's kind of a legal metaphor. But God is always on our side, so that no good happens to us except by God. God as the giver, because all of life is a gift. Any comments on that?
What about thinking in terms of God in your metaphors where you say God is not? In other words, when you talk about metaphors, most of them are in terms of God is and the difficulty that that presents in conceptualizing it. What if you think of it in terms of God is not this, God is not that? You don't try to define what he is, but you define what he is not.
Yeah, does that work, Carol?
What do you come up with? I mean, what's left after you said he isn't? He isn't this, he isn't.
I don't know, but one of the earlier comments he had was that metaphors limp, or they're always going to limp, and we're kind of beset with having to work with symbols. One of the feelings that I have is maybe we shouldn't struggle to try to pinpoint or even think a lot about what he is, but resolve in a way maybe what he isn't and leave it at that. Don't try to think what God is. Possibly at that time you're eating another apple off the tree in the Garden of Eden. You're trying to attain a type of knowledge that is beyond your grasp and you shouldn't be even attempting to attain.
But I think that also our metaphors change as we change, as we experience God in our life. Are we here? Or even after this session, we may change our metaphors. And if you don't have a metaphor or a symbol, he becomes like a vacuum in it. Hard relating as a human to a vacuum.
It becomes important to have the symbols or metaphors of God in terms of God is or even is not if you're going to relate about God. I didn't think of it in terms of if you're going to think about God, that you still think in symbols. But I'm wondering if a lot of the thought process about God. Just thinking about God is maybe even taking it to the point of being an endeavor that shouldn't be done. You should be experiencing rather than thinking. Let God become an instrument of God rather than taking your humanness and trying to associate. Like I think Ron used the word flow, letting things flow through. As you use metaphors or think about God or try to communicate about, well, God is this way, you may not be letting things flow through in a way.
That's assuming too that there's no revelation. And I guess part of the thing I think of Christ is doing is reconciling us in our lack of knowledge. You know, we do have some points to begin with, and maybe we get screwed up in where we go from them. But you know, there are some things to start with.
I wish Adam had described God a little more, you know.
Before he got kicked out, it would have been nice to give him a description.
You're not serious about that, are you?
Not too.
Yeah, because that would be impossible. Description would have to be in terms of the categories that we now know. You know, somebody, I can describe something to you that you have never seen, because I can refer to elements that are within your experience which that thing is like. But God is not like any of those. It's this which caused Paul Tillich to make the statement, God does not exist. By which he meant, God is not one of those entities which stick out of existence. Because if God were one of those entities, then he would not be God. He would just be one of the things within existence. And Tillich made the assertion once that the only non-symbolic statement you can make about God is God is being itself. Or alternatively, God is the ground of being. The trouble with that, and there are a number of troubles with that, but one trouble with that is that that is veering now toward the philosopher's God, who is incapable of arousing any passion. One of the reasons, I think Tillich has a beautiful comment on what we mean when we say God is a person. You know, what do we mean usually when we talk about a person? Well, we, depending again on our psychology, if we're Freudians, we may think, well, a person is someone with a superego, an ego, and an id. Well, we don't mean that about God. What do we mean? If we go down the line, try to say what we mean when we say God is a person, it turns out that all of the specific things that we mean when we speak of some other entity as a person are not applicable to God. But the one thing that is applicable to God is this, that Tillich says, only the concept of a person is capable of expressing at all the seriousness of the subjective relationship. Only a person is capable of addressing us in our innermost being, you know, so that we have to answer. Or, you know, turn something off so we can look away. I mean, if I see something, some substance oozing out of something lying there, and you say that's a water bottle with a leak, I turn away, I am unaffected. But if you say that's a squirrel bleeding, that is capable of addressing me. And I may have to turn away if I can't do anything, or minister, or of course, if I say that's Carol Nolte bleeding, you know. So when we use the concept of a person, we're talking about the reality of the inner life, the reality of the subjectivity of God, which addresses us. We're saying something like, here again, our language plays tricks on us. We're saying that God is a thou. You know, have any of you ever wondered why the Quakers used to say thee and thou? Huh? Well, it was because English, here's the way you used to conjugate the verb to be. I am, thou art, he, she, or it is. We are, you are, they are. You was plural. But you also was polite. Just as in German, ich bin, du bist, er ist, wir sind. Now, you can say, if you want to say you to someone in German, be polite. You don't say du bist. You wouldn't, for example, to your teacher, you wouldn't say du bist ein Lehrer. You would say sie sind, the plural, to be polite. All right. The Quakers were objecting to these distinctions among men. The Quakers were saying, we are all human beings. Therefore, everyone is a thou. But now we've lost that, because what happened is the polite form came to be the common form. And so every singular person today is a you. All right, well, that's why Buber, Martin Buber, in his book talks about the I-thou relationship. In the German, it's always a shock to someone who's learned German and then turns to the Bible, finds out that God is a du. It's the intimate form. It's the form you use in speaking to your children, not the form you use in speaking to your president or something. All right. So the thou relationship is an intimate relationship. Sonia?
Isn't it also the word, I think I remember Carol commenting on the word to know God in the Old Testament is the... It's using the same term as to know a woman. It's an intimate knowing, yes. Uh-huh. in the relationship between God and man.
Yeah, that's the Hebrew. I think it's yada is the Hebrew verb for to know, and it's used. And Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived. I've often wondered, though, whether that wasn't a kind of delicacy on the part of the writer. Well, but maybe it's significant, and, you know, kind of a euphemism.
At the end of Job, also it ends up that that God had wanted an intimate relationship with Job, all the works and the righteousness and all that. It was the relationship between a man and God that was important.
Okay. I want to turn to Buber. We use the word God a lot. Lots of people use the word God. I hope that sometimes you are offended by the use of the word God. And I'm not talking about when somebody gets his thumb with a hammer and says, God damn. I'm talking about, for example, football games in the Southwest Athletic Conference, when God is addressed at the beginning of the game. I am offended by that. I mean, proposed in the faculty meeting at SMU that we either admit that Southern Methodist University doesn't take the Methodists seriously and abandon the prayers before football games, or decide to take the Methodists seriously and abandon the prayers before football games. But then I found out it's a rule of the Southwest Athletic Conference that all football games must open with prayer. But there are all sorts of uses of the word God that ought to make us uneasy. And I don't think we ought to begin by judging others, but we ought to begin by judging ourselves, because I know that I tend to identify my causes, or to sanctify my causes, by invoking the name of God. I tend too easily to assume that God is on my side, and don't spend enough time finding out whether I am on God's side. In the prelude to this beautiful little book, Eclipse of God, by Martin Buber, who died a few years ago, a Jewish philosopher, theologian, He tells about two talks. The first one, which I'm not going to read, he was talking at an adult folk school in a German industrial city, and one of the working men got up afterwards and said, "You've been talking about God. I don't need this hypothesis God in order to explain the world." And Buber talked to him later, and they had long conversations. And at the end of the conversation, the man said, let me just read this paragraph. "When I was through, a stern silence ruled. Then the man raised his heavy lids, which had been lowered the whole time, and said, slowly and impressively, 'You are right.' I sat in front of him dismayed. What had I done? I had led the man to the threshold beyond which there sat enthroned the majestic image which the great physicist, the great man of faith, Pascal, called the God of the philosophers. Had I wished for that? Had I not rather wished to lead him to the other, him whom Pascal called the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, him to whom one can say, 'Thou'? It grew dusk. It was late. On the next day I had to depart. I could not remain as I now ought to do. I could not enter into the factory where the man worked, become his comrade, live with him, win his trust through real life relationship, help him to walk with me the way of the creature who accepts the creation. I could only return his gaze." Now, another, sometime later, and this is the one I'll tell you, it's this long. "Sometime later, I was the guest of a noble old thinker. I had once made his acquaintance at a conference where he gave a lecture on elementary folk schools, and I gave one on adult folk schools. That brought us together, for we were united by the fact that the word folk has to be understood in both cases in the same all-embracing sense. At that time, I was happily surprised at how the man with the gray steel-gray locks asked us at the beginning of his talk to forget all that we believed we knew about his philosophy from his books. In the last years, which had been war years, reality had been brought so close to him that he saw everything with new eyes and had to think in a new way. As old man, I do. To be old is a glorious thing when one has not unlearned what it means to begin. This old man had even perhaps first learned it thoroughly in old age. He was not at all young, but he was old in a young way, knowing how to begin. He lived in another university city situated in the West. When the theology students of that university invited me to speak about prophecy, I stayed with the old man. There was a good spirit in his house, a spirit that wills to enter life and does not prescribe to life where it shall let it in. One morning, I got up early to read proofs. The evening before, I had received galley proof of the preface of a book of mine, and since this preface was a statement of faith, I wished to read it once again quite carefully before it was printed. Now I took it into the study below that had been offered to me in case I should need it. But here the old man already sat at his writing desk. Directly after greeting me, he asked me what I had in my hand. When I told him, he asked whether I would not read it aloud to him. I did so gladly. He listened in a friendly manner, but clearly astonished, indeed with growing amazement. When I was through, he spoke hesitatingly, then, carried away by the importance of his subject, ever more passionately, "How can you bring yourself to say God time after time? How can you expect that your readers will take the word in the sense in which you wish it to be taken? What you mean by the name of God is something above all human grasp and comprehension, but in speaking about it, you have lowered it to human conceptualization. What word of human speech is so misused, so defiled, so desecrated as this? All the innocent blood that has been shed for it has robbed it of its radiance. All the injustice that has been used to cover has effaced its features. When I hear the highest called God, it sometimes seems almost blasphemous." That's the old man speaking. Buber says, "The kindly, clear eyes flamed, the voice itself flamed. Then we sat silent for a while facing each other. The room lay in the flowing brightness of early morning. It seemed to me as if a power from the light entered into me. What I now answered, I cannot today reproduce, but only indicate. 'Yes,' I said, 'it is the most heavy laden of all human words. None has become so soiled, so mutilated. Just for this reason, I may not abandon it. Generations of men have laid the burden of their anxious lives upon this word and weighed it to the ground. It lies in the dust and bears their whole burden. The races of man with their religious factions have torn the word to pieces. They've killed for it and died for it. And it bears their finger marks and their blood. Where might I find a word like it to describe the highest? If I took the purest, most sparkling concept from the inner treasure chamber of the philosophers, I could only capture thereby an unbinding product of thought. I could not capture the presence of him whom the generations of men have honored and degraded with their awesome living and dying. I do indeed mean, when I say God, him whom the hell-tormented and heaven-storming generations of men mean. Certainly they draw caricatures and write God underneath. They murder one another and say, in God's name. But when all madness and delusion fall to dust, when they stand over against him in the loneliest darkness and no longer say, he, but rather sigh, thou, shout, thou, all of them the one word, and when they then add God, is it not the real God whom they all implore, the one living God, the God of the children of man? Is it not he who hears them? And just for this reason is not the word God, the word of appeal, the word which has become a name, consecrated in all human tongues for all times? We must esteem those who forbid it, because they rebel against the injustice and wrong which are so readily referred to God for authorization. But we may not give it up. How understandable it is that some suggest we should remain silent about the last things for a time in order that the misused words may be redeemed. But they are not to be redeemed thus. We cannot cleanse the word God, and we cannot make it whole. But defiled and mutilated as it is, we can raise it from the ground and set it over an hour of great care. And then he concludes. It had become very light in the room. It was no longer dawning, it was light. The old man stood up, came over to me, laid his hand on my shoulder and spoke. Let us be friends. The conversation was completed. For where two or three are truly together, they are together in the name of God.